You know, again, it is incredible to think that God makes himself available to us. And not only does he make himself available to us on the outside, he also comes and infuses us with power in his presence in our individual lives as well. You know, we're in Joshua chapter 18 and talked about the tent of meeting, you know, being placed in Shiloh in Israel. And the representation of that is, again, the presence of God there amongst the Jews, but then the access they had to God. And reinforcing both of those, and yet how little we take advantage of that. You know, how often it is true that we spend more time grieving and quenching the Spirit than we do spend living and being filled with the Spirit. You know, how oftentimes we struggle with situations and deal with things in our lives without going to God, without bringing it to Him, without coming to Him. And to think that the God of the universe makes Himself available to that is truly incredible. So if there's anything we'd be encouraged by the idea of that, you know, just what the Bible talks about, the tent of meeting, and that again, it would cause us to be more aware and more available in terms of what, or really taking advantage of the availability that God gives to us. Now, something that I think we might have shown this slide, but as far as making the connection of where Shiloh is, if you see that big Israel, right, you know, to kind of 2 o'clock to that is where Shiloh is. So kind of right in the middle of Israel, you see, you know, the Dead Sea at the bottom there on the right-hand side, and then Jerusalem, you know, where the capital of Israel will eventually be, or more appropriately, the region of Judah. But Shiloh being there, and again, that's where the tent of meeting was. It's where it was through the book of Judges, through, you know, going into 1 Samuel. The Philistines get it for a time, and then it comes back, and then David eventually brings it to Jerusalem. And so now moving on from there, we see, if you look at, you know, another thing that happens in chapter 18 is, you know, again, the tent of meeting comes to Shiloh, and then all those tribes that didn't get their inheritance. Like, you have 5 tribes that get their inheritance. Basically, Joshua says, hey, come and tell me what you want. You know, we're going to decide about how we're dividing the land. And 5 tribes come, and they receive their allotment. And then 7 tribes don't. And it's like, where are you? You didn't take us up on our offer. You got to grasp hold of the things that God is giving you. So that's what happens in Shiloh. Basically, okay, for you tribes that haven't come and you haven't done your work, you haven't come and grasped hold of what God is available, making available to you, come to Shiloh, and we're going to divide the land from there. And so that's what happens in chapter 18 and 19. And so this is the picture. This map summarizes what really has happened in Joshua 13 and 14, now 18 and 19. In terms of just what portions of the area of Palestine each tribe received. So again, all the designations, all the things we would otherwise read about, you know, this one's property or this one's territory was like this mountain or that river or this area or that location or whatever, that's what it results in. And so in the midst of all of this, in terms of God allotting different territories to the different tribes, another thing that is really carried out, God has given instruction about these things in the book of Deuteronomy and in the book of Numbers, but now what Joshua is doing is Joshua is now fulfilling those things. He's distributing those things. He's putting those things in place. And so chapter 20 of Joshua talks about these cities of refuge. These cities of refuge, 6 of them would be spattered around this area of Palestine. And basically what those cities of refuge was for was someone who accidentally and unintentionally killed someone. And when you think about all the things that can happen in tragedy as far as someone dying, someone being killed, particularly at the hand of someone else. Well, understanding in terms of jurisprudence, in terms of the justice of God, the truth of God, what he would do in orchestrating a community, he would recognize that there's a sharp distinction between someone who intends and purposes to kill someone and someone who doesn't intend to, and yet it happens. you know, in terms of the book of Deuteronomy, it actually goes through different incidences as far as, you know, you're swinging an axe and the axe head breaks off and it hits someone in the head and they die. You know, you push someone or you bump into someone and they fall over something and they hit their head on a rock and they die. You know, it gives different examples of, you know, what kind of unintentional things there are. It's actually interesting in terms of our law. You know, there's some aspects of trying to distinguish how intentional you were. Like, you know, maybe you weren't intentional about killing someone, but you were negligent in your actions. You know, you were driving fast and you killed someone. Okay, you didn't mean to kill someone, but you were driving fast and trying to, you know, parse out those different things as far as responsibility. But these cities of refuge were, well, I mean, in some ways it does indicate how messy situations can be and how important it is to make sure that we have a time of pause, a time of reflection, a time of making sure that things are handled in a just way, a fair way, and that's what these cities of refuge are all about. Again, a place for people to go when someone kills someone accidentally and without intention. It was to save them from the avenger of blood. That's the word that's used in the passages that talk about the cities of refuge. Basically, what that means is that even though you kill someone unintentionally, it doesn't mean that people who are in that person's life aren't upset about the fact that they've died. And so therefore, if I'm upset about that, the fact that this person has died, even if you have done it unintentionally, I might take justice into my own hands. I might actually, okay, life for a life, the tooth for a tooth, you know, you killed someone, now I'm going to come and kill you. And so the whole idea was, no, run to the city of refuge, and that's where you present yourself there, and we want to make sure that a trial happens. And again, this conversation about the whole situation that is going on. And so basically what the person would do is they would go to the city of refuge, they would look to the elders of the city in terms of pressing their case, explaining the situation that was going on, and then they would make a decision in regards to that. Again, if it was found that the person was unintentional, they would stay there until it's just a strange designation, until the high priest at that time passed away, when the high priest died. And what I think that meant is that it gave an objective standard. It gave something that all the community would recognize as far as this is what is just, this is what is fair, this is what we all understand, that there should be a time frame for those emotions to be parsed out. It should be a time frame where that person doesn't necessarily make this action, go to the city of refuge, have this case happen, and then just go back to normal life. You know, in terms of trusting people or how people would feel about that person being there, like, that's the guy. Again, he didn't mean to kill the person, but he was swinging the axe. Yes, the axe head did fall off, but, you know, again, dealing with just what would come up from that in terms of human circumstance and human emotion. And so basically looking at objective standard of, again, how long does that person stay in that city of refuge? How much is too long? How much is too short? Well, for the community to recognize, okay, here is this spiritual leader in terms of the counsel of God, the intervention of God, the presence of God in the community of Israel. Well, when he has passed and now a new era of a new high priest comes in, that's when people would be released from the cities of refuge and go back to normal living. And so basically, again, this whole process is to assure a fair trial, assure objectivity, you know, to make sure subjective feeling isn't the thing that's coming along, but it's really reinforcing the fact that God is a God of justice. You know, it reveals God's justice, and that justice is best left to law and authority. Justice is not best left to human emotion. You know, human evaluation of what they think in terms of what the best course of action is to take in a situation. But God is a God of justice. He does care about things handling things correctly. You know, even to make the distinction between someone passing through intent and by murder, as opposed to something that is unintentional. Even when we think about the laws that exist in different communities that recognize this distinction, you know, to see that God put this in place for the people of Israel and how he was orchestrating a society. You know, when you read the Old Testament, one of the things you internalize and one of the things you get from it is, again, if God was making a society, if God was establishing rules and establishing how that society would work, that's what the Old Testament is all about. And so these cities of refuge, to me, are such a great expression of, again, God's wisdom and his justice in terms of what he is orchestrating. But how can that not cause us to think about God being our refuge? Again, when you think about being in that situation where, okay, I didn't mean to kill someone, but I understand people are upset with me. What do I do? Where do I go? Go to the city of refuge. I feel like I'm misunderstood. I feel like, again, they may not understand that I didn't mean to do this. And where to go to the city of refuge. And yet, how often is that a description of our lives as believers? And to recognize the God of the universe offers himself as a place of refuge. He offers a place of release, a place of comfort in terms of what he brings. You know, we think about how consistently the Bible, you know, again, a place to run to, literally dozens upon dozens of times, in dozens of ways, God describes himself as a refuge, as a place to run to. Again, when life has dealt you a difficult situation or a wrong blow or people have treated you unfairly or whatever it might be, to know that God says, come to me. See me as a refuge. You know, you think about the ways, again, that's expressed in terms of cast your cares upon me. You know, take my yoke upon you and come and know that my burden is light and I'll help you carry that burden. Like all the ways that the God of the universe comes to us, again, in a very personal way, you know, recognizing how life is difficult. People are difficult. Relationships are difficult. There's going to be things that we deal with in terms of the evil of man, the finiteness of man, the finiteness of our body, the vagaries of economies and politics and so on and so forth. And for the God of the universe to say, okay, at any point in time you want to come, you come to me. And I seek to be a refuge for you. You know, you think about one of the things that the Bible talks about, he is a hiding place. You know, you think about the things you go through and the things you deal with. Again, you feel like you're misunderstood or no one understands me. No one gets to what I'm thinking. No one gets what I'm going through. I try to explain myself to people and they just don't understand. Well, you know something? God will always understand. God would always give you a place to come and vent, process. You know, if there's anything the book of Psalms teaches us about God, is God wants to hear our venting. He wants to hear even the raw emotion that comes from us in terms of, God, I'm really mad, or I'm really afraid that I need this resolved, I need this fixed, I need this addressed, I need to come to you. But I would say that in the presence of all the things that we deal with, there's a logistical side, and then there's a personal relationship side. Amen? And it was the logistical, okay, fix the relationship, bring the money in, let me get the job, blah, blah, you know, whatever it might be. But then there's, God, I'm hurt. God, I'm sad. God, I'm angry. God, I'm afraid. And how comforting to know that God desires to be a hiding place. You know, what does Jesus say? If I had my will, I would take my, like a chick gathers, or a hen gathers chicks under her wings and say, come to mommy, and you're okay. You're safe. You're loved. I know you. You know me. I care for you. And now, as God is your hiding place, nothing else matters. You know, it's amazing to me how we do not plan worship. I mean, like the worship team plans worship, but I don't say, okay, Becky, you know, my message today is about your refuge, God being a refuge and coming to him, every single song just about talked about the aspect of God being a refuge. God, into your presence. And so to recognize the God of the universe, that's what he offers himself to you as. A hiding place, a place of solace, a place of help, a place of protection. You know, it's your creator. It's a God of the universe. It's the authority over everything. And for him to come to you and, again, sit at my feet, come get wrapped in my arms in terms of all the things that I would bring to you. And to recognize that is open 24/7. God will never say to you, sorry, you woke me up. You know, don't you know I was busy? You know, you caught me at a bad time. You know, or I don't understand. Or, you know, so I really can't help. You know, that problem there, that's just too big to me. Let me consult over here as far as let me try and figure out what. No, again, he has the power. He has the truth. He has the provision in terms of all that he would orchestrate for us in that. And to recognize at any point in time, into any time your heart wants to seek God and reach out to God, God is available. You know, there's a I'm trying to think of who the person that wrote the book Practicing the Presence of God. And then part of the way that we practice the presence of God is to recognize he is always there, he's always available. Like there's a point in time where you're just doing your day. And you're making your choice and you're doing your work and people are coming around and, you know, there's good things happening, there's bad things happening, there's relationships that flow and then there's relationships where there's conflict. And at any point in time for you to say, God, help. God, intervene. God, guide me. God, provide. That transfer of heart where now I'm just thinking about the circumstance, I'm just thinking about the relationship, now all of a sudden, wait a minute, God, I need you. And again, God is available for that 24/7. So again, the fact that God is our refuge, God is a place to run to. Again, you think about the emotional circumstances of someone dying. And I got to get to the city of refuge because that's where my hope is. That's where my help is. And to know that that's what God is for us. But when we come to God, we must understand three things. Again, if we're going to seek God as a refuge, we must understand three things about God. Is that we have to come to him on his terms. You know, for all these things that we'll talk about here, we don't have to be there right away, but we have to recognize what God is always leading us to. Or if you come to God, and maybe at one point in time it worked, and then all of a sudden it doesn't work, it might be because God is reinforcing these standards. And so again, we have to come to God on his terms. It's the only thing that he can support. See, part of the reality of coming to the God of truth, the God of authority, the creator, he knows exactly what is right. And there isn't exactly what is right every time. Like he has an answer for everything in terms of what you should do, what should happen, what he's seeking to accomplish. Again, he is never confused. He is never bothered. He is never troubled. He is never overwhelmed. He's never overcome. You know, but you have to come to him on his terms to receive that. You know, primarily that's through Jesus, by the cross, and accessing him in that way. His terms are also just what he's calling you to in your life. You know, what would be obedience? What would be righteousness? What would be godliness? You know, God is going to be a refuge to those that are ungodly. You know, come to me and, you know, again, I'll console, I'll comfort, I'll give you solace, but where am I going to lead you to? Like at some point in time, I'll commiserate with you in terms of the consequence of your life, the consequences of your choices, the consequences of your behavior. But now, let's get to the right place. Let's understand why you got here in the first place, and let's make sure that doesn't happen again. So again, it is always you had to come to him on his terms. We have to come to him by faith. See, again, we come to him on his terms because he cannot support, he cannot condone anything else. We come to him by faith because he is spirit. You know, when I think of refuge, I can't help but think about the other places people go to get refuge. I would say life in the world is about finding refuge. I would say everyone in the world is trying to find something that brings comfort to life, excitement to life, solace to life. Yeah, you do the work week and you grind it out and you do the thing. Why? So you can go on vacation. Again, I'm seeking that refuge. Think about people that are hooked on drugs and alcohol because I'm seeking a refuge. Think about the impurity that exists in her life because I'm seeking a refuge. Everyone is seeking a refuge. Now, what's significant about God being a refuge is it's by faith. Like the reason why the world is appealing is because I can see it. I can touch it. I can experience it now. Again, it's my physical being can be engaged in this. So now, all of a sudden, this seems like a refuge because, again, I experience it physically. Like, we have to understand that when we come to God, we come to him by faith. We come to him by spirit. And so, therefore, there's a process. Like, there's an aspect of you coming to God as a refuge, and that how much God is a refuge should always increase in your life. Like how much you internalize the presence of God, how much that presence of God has gone from I'm believing something to knowing something. Again, that will change as you grow. And that process of being in the Word and being in prayer and being in worship and being in the Spirit, being in church, being around Christian people, all those things enhancing the influence of God. You know, when you talk to believers and they talk about relationship with God that you just don't get. Like, in other words, if I were to talk about you, there's a very rare circumstance that I can, in the eye of a storm, just find a place of peace all the time. Again, those five P's of the Christian life that I talk about: God's person, his presence, his power, his provision, his plan. Boom. Again, hardship, hurt, disagreement, conflict, okay, God, you're with me. You're a person who I know who you are. You have a plan, you have power, and you have provision. Now let's go. But if you don't believe, like if you don't know that, like that comes to, like so my point being, if you talk to people and you're not or you then their experience of Christian life and you don't have that, you know, realize what God is encouraging you to do is build up that aspect of faith. Like that person has been exposed to the knowledge of God, they've been available to the influence of God, and now they're at that point. And the beauty of God is that nothing will hold you back but you. Like you grow in spirit, you grow in faith, you grow in knowledge, and by definition, all of a sudden, God being a refuge works. It helps. Then all of a sudden, your soul is comforted because you know that person. And so, but again, it's by faith. It's like there's a spiritual dynamic. There's a dynamic of not flesh. You know, I think we have to realize that there are some aspects of our engagement in the things of flesh that can actually be disruptive to that process of growing in spirit. Certainly when we're talking about sin. Certainly when we talk about things that gratify us in the flesh. And again, it's a refuge in terms of sin. That's going to corrupt our engagement with God in terms of coming to him in faith. And we come to him fully. See, we come to him on his terms because that's the only thing that he can support. We come to him by faith because he is spirit and he's not physical. And we come to him fully because God will not share his glory with anyone. Again, you don't have, like, part of God being a refuge is, God, I'm not there. You know, I have I have faith. What did the guy say? I have belief. Help my unbelief. You know, sometimes, you know, the engagement with God, God being a refuge, like, complete me, God. Fix me. Bring me to that place. And I know I'm not where I'm supposed to be. My refuge, because I want to get there. Yeah, okay, God's okay with that. But realize what God is always directing us to is it has to be fully. Like at some point, like I said before, at some point in time when that's not working, boy, God was a refuge. I was at this level of maturity. I was at this level of understanding. I was seeking God and I pursued him. I felt the Spirit. Now it doesn't work. Are you coming to him fully? Is there an aspect of your life that you're holding on to and saying, God, no, I want this too much. I'm not going to surrender that. I surrender all? Well, let me tell you, you surrender all, and God will be more available. Now, all of a sudden, him being a refuge for you is going to be more significant in terms of what that means for your life. But again, he can't share his glory with anyone else. He can't make what comes from you work, ultimately, because if what you develop and you contrive and you accomplish, if that worked, like without him, then he would have to share his glory with you. And that's just not true. Again, God does not share his glory with others because he's insecure. He does that because that's the only thing that's true. Like the only thing that's true is that God gets credit for everything. Yes, you have your part and he shares inheritance. He shares reward. He affirms you in terms of good and faithful servant, good going, be obedient and be confident and have joy in the fact of your obedience. But that obedience always has to be based in him. So everyone, again, we throw our crowns at Jesus' feet. Why? Because he's the, the way I imagine that picture, again, once again, a song we sang, unplanned, is maybe in the, like if you can imagine that we're in heaven and we have any aspect of our human understanding and ego. And I don't think that happens. Just imagine this picture I'm trying to paint. Like you think the crowns are something. Like, look at, these are the people that I witnessed to. This is the service I performed for God. These are the people I helped. This is the money I gave. Look at all the crowns I have. And then you see Jesus. Then you see God. And you realize that makes no sense. How can I take credit for anything? You know, it says in the Bible, I think in 1 Corinthians, there'll be no boasting in heaven. No place for boasting. Like, that's why salvation has to be about grace. It has to be about faith. Everyone will be in heaven because of what Jesus did, not because of what you did. Like, if there was any work that you did to make yourself right with God in terms of being in heaven, then God would be sharing his glory. And he can't do it because it's just not true. He would be lying. If he shared his glory with someone, he would be lying, and God cannot lie. And so again, that's why we have to come to him fully. That's why in the process of God being a refuge, it's, oh, okay, let's get that thing right. Let's fix that thing. Let's overcome that thing. Here's the power. Here's the truth. Here's the people. Let's get that done. And so we come to him fully. That's chapter 20. Chapter 21 talks about the Levites did not receive an inheritance of territory, but they, you know, God, you know, recognized that they have to live, they have to eat. It's wise for them to work and produce. They were given cities, 48 of them, that the different tribes gave to them. And again, we saw that that's a purifying influence, that's a sanctifying influence. 48 cities throughout the tribes of Israel were the Levites, the ones that were serving in the temple, those who would represent God, that would be more aware of the truth of God to teach and to bring conviction in the situations that the Israelites found themselves to. I think that's what God's plan was. Now, it is interesting that six of those Levitical cities were the cities of refuge. And so when you think about the cities of refuge, who's best to be in that city but the Levites, the ones that, again, their portion is God. The thing they're oriented in their lives isn't possession and how much land do I have and what. No, my service is to God. You know, again, I have this place to live, to farm, and you know, work, and so on and so forth. But you know, those people would be the ones that would be the ones making decisions. You know, bringing justice. You know, holding a trial in terms of making decision. And so, didn't we have the better map? You can't. That this has the 48 cities, but you know, yeah, there you go. And so the black dots are the Levitical cities, and as you can see, the red dots. It's more just a scope frame in terms of understanding. You know, that map that you saw about the division of the tribes. Now this is superimposed on that, the Levitical cities and the cities of refuge, just to give you a sense of what the Bible is talking about. Again, it's a picture is worth a thousand words. It's at least reading through verse 21. I mean, chapter 21, in terms of that portion. But I do want to quickly try to get to 22, because I really want to, and there's good stuff in chapter 22. I do want to try and finish Joshua next week. So to just realize that again, okay, chapter 22. Again, where we've been, it's again very consistent. The tribes get their allotments, they kind of get what the possession they're going to have. What we have to understand is that some of those tribes were on the eastern side of the Jordan. So basically, as the people of Israel are coming into Palestine, and they say, okay, we're defeating these kings on the east side of the Jordan. Before we defeat the kings on the west side of the Jordan, well, Gad, Manasseh, and the half-tribe of Manasseh and Ephraim say, not Ephraim, Reuben. So hard to get those names mixed up, right? I mean, so easy to get those names. So Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh say, you know something, we like this property over here. We really like the way the fields are fertile and the ground is good and, you know, the mountains or the sheep or the whatever it was that attracted them. We want to be on the east side of the Jordan. So Moses says, well, okay, I guess I can let that happen, but what you have to guarantee me is that you help your brothers fight their wars on the west side of the Jordan. So come and fight with us, and then once we have peace, like everyone together has defeated people on the east side of the Jordan. Now come with everybody and defeat the people on the west side of the Jordan. So like the book of Joshua, again, it's grab hold, it's fight, it's get it done, reach out to what God has provided, and then it's about rest. Then it's about, okay, the work is done. And so basically 22 is saying, hey, Reubenites, Gadites, half-tribe of Manasseh, you have done what you said you're going to do. Again, what a promise kept and a promise rewarded. They said they were going to do it. You did it. Now you can go back to your territory in terms of what you would possess. And all seems hunky-dory until you get to verse 10, I believe it is, right? And until verse 10. And this is where some relational stuff comes up, which is, I think, very useful to us today. And so it says in verse 10, again, Joshua says what he says to them. They go off in terms of what they're doing. And then in verse 10, when they came to Geliloth, near the Jordan and land of Canaan, the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh built an imposing altar there by the Jordan. And when the Israelites heard that they had built the altar on the border of Canaan at Geliloth, near the Jordan on Israel's side, the whole assembly of Israel gathered at Shiloh to go to war against them. Wait a minute, we were just one happy family. You ever had that situation? We just had Christmas. We just had Thanksgiving, and like we were talking nice, and now we're going to go to war with you? Unfortunately, that is too consistently representative of the nature of human relationships. Amen? This is life. This is what I should have emphasized when I talked about Shiloh is, again, when the tent of meeting is in Shiloh, then basically the word is you come to Shiloh. You want to bring your sacrifices, you want to meet God, you come to the tent of meeting, and that's where you do that. And so why this is so offensive to the people, the tribes on the west side is what? What are you doing? You're breaking a foundational rule of how God has defined things here. But I think the real lesson for us is we have to be so careful. Oh yeah, all seems hungry. Yeah. It's so important to protect yourself from presumption and overreaction. Like, how often is it you learn something, you find something out, the story comes down the pike, and now all of a sudden you're upset. Now all of a sudden you're presuming the what's, the how's, the wherefore's, the why's of what someone has done, and now all of a sudden you're getting reactionary. Protect yourself. Stop that. Like, I would even say, if you have something coming up in your heart that is negative towards someone else, don't let that thought fester until you talk to the person. Whether that's about what they've done, how they've done it, or why they've done it, don't let that negative thought continue in your mind until you talk to them. Because basically what these Western tribes are doing is, well, by definition, like basically the way we always internalize things is they must be thinking what I'm thinking. We can only think from the perspective of how we think. And so therefore, if I was building an altar, this is what it would mean to me. If I was building an altar, it would mean that I'm being defiant. It means, but you don't know that about the other person. Well, if I was listening to that music, then I would be. If I was drinking that thing, then that would mean for me. So by definition, it must be. No, you can't. Particularly those Romans 14 things, those areas where some people feel freedom and some people don't feel freedom. Yeah, your conscience is telling you, yeah, that is wrong, so it must mean. Don't presume and don't overreact. That's what's happening here. Presumption and overreaction. And so in verse 13, that they do make a good step here, though. Again, rather than actually going to war, they send a delegation. So, you know, bad to do the presumption and the overreaction, but at least don't act in that. I mean, don't do it for like, be at peace for all. Like, if after talking to someone you learn that you should be upset, then you should be upset. Like, boy, it seems like you did that because this is true. Oh yeah, that is true. Okay, well now I'm at least upset about the right thing. Like, rather than presuming that you're doing something wrong, now I know you're doing something wrong. Now we have a different thing to talk about. In verse 13, so the Israelites sent Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the priest, to the land of Gilead, to Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh. With him they sent 10 of the chief men, one from each tribe of Israel, each the head of a family division among the Israelites. This really represents authority, it's representation, it's observation in terms of, you know, all the people that those people regard, that's who we're sending. You know, it's going to be representative of the different tribes. So to think about that as you're maybe confronting a situation, we're trying to address who are we choosing to be part of this? Who's going to be engaging in the situation and what makes sense? So that I think there's wisdom as to who is being chosen here. So I think that translates to us about how would we resolve conflict. And they don't act on their reaction. They send a delegation. I think that a delegation is about the right authority, the right representation, people to observe. Like, what happened? How do the Gadites, the Manasseh and Reuben, interact? I mean, how do they, you know, internalize and react? Oh, it was, you know, people to observe. Like, plenty of people say, oh, yeah, it went well. That's the point there. So in verse 15, when they went to Gilead, to Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, they said to them, the whole assembly of the Lord says, how could you break faith with... You know, okay, let's not read that, actually. Just trust me, you know, again, because we have communion today, and so I want to leave time for you. Just realize, if you read 15 through 20, they really lay it on thick. Like, they really lay it on, like, well, how dare you? You built the altar. You want to bring God's judgment on us. You know, they bring up Achan. Remember Achan? Remember the fact that when he sinned, everyone got judged for that? So, you know, make sure, like, we're here to make sure you're not doing something wrong. We're the truth police. We're the righteousness police. We're the God-fearing police, and so we're here. Maybe it's justified. I say justified. Maybe that they do lay it on thick. So I think this is part of their presumption. Again, well, you're sinning, so therefore, let me presume what God's going to do about that. But look at what Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh say in verse 21. Then Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh replied to the heads of the city's clans of Israel, the mighty one God, the Lord, the mighty one, the God of the Lord. He knows, and let Israel know, if this had been in rebellion or disobedience to the Lord, do not spare us this day. If we have built our own altar to turn away from the Lord, to offer burnt offerings and grain offerings, and to sacrifice fellowship offerings on it, may the Lord himself call us to account. I think what this represents is, you know what they do? They show that they've internalized what the other people have said. Even though the other people, you've poured it on thick, like I want to be reactionary to that. Like, how dare you say that I'm this or I'm that? But, you know, hey, you know something? I get that. Like, in other words, what they're saying is, even though you're laying it on thick, I understand why you would do that. God's worthy of that laying it on thick. I internalize. Like, if I had done that, if I am in that, then absolutely you're right. But let me tell you that I'm not in that place. But they internalize what they had heard and identify with it. Do you hear that? Oh, wow. Like that's why you're here? like you thought that was the case? You saw me here and you thought I was doing that? You know something? If I was doing that, then you're absolutely right to confront me. You're absolutely right to deal with that. But now let me tell you what it does represent to me. No, we did it for fear that someday your descendants might say to ours, what do you have to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? The Lord has made the Jordan a boundary between us and you. You Reubenites and Gadites, you have no share in the Lord. So your descendants might cause ours to stop fearing the Lord. So again, that's their motivation. Like, so basically, again, take this to 20th century, 21st century United States. Relationships get broken. Misunderstandings happen. Presumption and reaction happen. This is real life right here. And again, as I'm responding, hey, let me tell you, let me identify what you said. Let me, you know, appreciate what you said. And now let me tell you what's true. Like, basically, what you say I'm doing in defiance of God, I'm doing it in regard for God. And when you think about the mix of how that can happen, even you think about our Christian lives, and again, particularly those Romans 14 things where, if you're doing that, that must mean, you know, you're talking about objective sin. We're not talking about that. We're talking about these gray areas where one person's conscience says this, that person's conscience says that, and presumption, reaction. Hey, you know something? If that's what you really thought, but that's not what it means to me. That's not what I'm doing. But let me be informed by your reaction. If you think of it that way, maybe other people think of that way, so maybe I should change the way I think about that. They internalized what they heard and identified. They addressed the concern, and then the Western tribe, you know, lets it be. But the whole point being, there was this presumption and misunderstanding, and so they send the delegate to reconcile. And again, don't let that negative thought foster without conversation. Never watch out being presuming. Watch out for the reaction. Just go to the person. Did that mean that? Well, you said that, and it seems like that. And can we have a conversation? I think more and more that should define our lives. More and more for us as believers, that's a way. Like how I can't believe you thought that. No, well, yeah, I can understand how you thought that of me. Yeah, I can imagine me being that. I don't like, and then like the whole, you know, log in my eye and the speck of dust in yours. Yeah, I get that. I'll take responsibility for that. But now does that make sense to you now? Do you understand why I would do that? You know, that basically what Reuben, if you didn't get it, like, we want this altar here so that now when we're on the east side of the Jordan and we come to Shiloh, we don't want the western tribe to say, you know, have no part in us. Like, how dare you come from the east side of the Jordan and come over here? No, we want to reinforce to you and to us that we have a place with you. So again, they're doing it in fidelity to God. And that just have to understand that that's like it's both shows the acceptable nature of things like that. like how it's possible for that to be the resolution. I think it's this, you think it's that. Well, you know something, that's about fidelity to you, for to God to you, then fine, then go. You be you, I'll be me. You'll be on the east side, I'll be on the west side, and we're still family. We're not going to bring out all-out war because, oh my gosh, you built an altar at the Jordan. But the point being, that can happen. The more important point, though, is the lesson it brings to relationship. That's how Christian relationships should go. That's how we should function in our life together. And so we will consider Joshua 22 completed, and we'll try to do 23 and 24 next week. I apologize, Mark. Mark, like whatever you do for communion, I apologize for extending your day, your time, Mark's time, whatever. So, but let's pray. Father, we are grateful that you are our refuge. You are our strength. I pray for anyone here that doesn't know that, doesn't understand it. I don't know what to say if you don't want it, but God, I just pray you meet them where they are in terms of just revealing yourself to be the God of glory, the God of presence, the God of care, the God of compassion, desiring to be a refuge. But we would understand the benefit that comes from surrendering all, the truth and reality that is defined by surrendering all, that you are the only one that is in a place to say what is right and wrong, to define define reality, define truth. Well, there's so much that we can get caught up in our subjective selves. And Father, we need to be purified by the truth of God. I pray that whatever is going on in that process of us engaging with you as a refuge, I pray that you bring it to completion and fullness in each of our lives. I do pray that you work through relationships. I pray that the example of these Western tribes and the Gadites, Manasseh, and Reubenites would be a lesson that we would remember that this week and the coming weeks, as far as how presumption can is not a good dynamic, and how reaction is often not a good dynamic, but conversation is a good dynamic, and all that Jesus brings in the context of that. And so, Father, it is all because of Him, through Him, for Him. And as we celebrate communion, I pray that you remind us of that, that that is reinforced now as we engage physically with you with elements, that we would grow in spirit and appreciation for all that you are and all that you make possible. It is in your Son, Jesus Christ's name, that we do pray. Amen.